Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt cordially invites you to take tea with her again today in the Colonial Room of the Park Sheraton Hotel in New York City for a discussion titled Pakistan Looks to the Future. Mrs. Roosevelt's guests are the distinguished Prime Minister of Pakistan, Liaquat Ali Khan, and his wife, Begum Liaquat Ali Khan, also United States Assistant Secretary of State, George C. McGee. Now, before our discussion begins, perhaps you would like, by means of this map, to have your recollection of this area refreshed so that we can look at some of the portions of the Indo-Pakistan subcontinent and take a quick journey through the important areas of this, one of the world's newest nations. Pakistan is divided into two parts, separated by intervening Indian territory, East Pakistan and West Pakistan. Western Pakistan, the larger of the two areas, contains the smaller number of people, about 35 million altogether. The federal capital of Pakistan is Karachi, which is an excellent natural seaport and the largest and busiest airport in all of Asia. Strategically, this is one of the most important areas, for here is the Khyber Pass, through which in past generations almost all invasions from Alexander the Great on moved east into the subcontinent. The gateway to the Khyber Pass is here at the town of Peshawar, which is the capital of the Northwest Province, and you'll recall the setting for many of Rudyard Kipling's famous stories and poems. In this area are produced sufficient food grains to supply a surplus of 600,000 tons available for export every year. It also produces the famous long staple cotton, some of the finest carpet wools in the world, as well as crude drugs, hides and skin, salt, oil, and other important minerals. A bordering West Pakistan, Northern India, and Eastern Pakistan, we note the following areas, which we'll pass in clockwise order. The Arabian Sea, Iran, Afghanistan, a portion of the USSR, Soviet Russia, the disputed state of Kashmir, China, Tibet, Nepal, and here we reach Burma on the east. And now let us turn to East Pakistan, with its population of some 45 million, although its area is considerably less than West Pakistan. The leading port of this area is Chittagong. The provincial capital is here at Dhaka. Eastern Pakistan grows 75% of the world's jute, also an important producer of tea, rice, hides, skins, and grasses used in the manufacture of paper. Our guest today will discuss the past, the present, and of course, most interest to the world, the future of Pakistan. And now I'm very happy to introduce Mrs. Roosevelt.
I'm so happy to have you with us, Mr. Prime Minister, and also you, Begum Sahiba, and you, Mr. McGee. It's a very great pleasure to have you come to me this afternoon, because I think all of us in this country are anxious to know more about this new country which has come into being so recently. Could you tell us a little bit how you came to be a country, Mr. Prime Minister?
Yes, Mrs. Roosevelt. If I may say, not a new country, but a new democracy that has come into being. And it's not even 3 years old yet. Well, I wouldn't go into the history as to why Pakistan came into being, because that, I think, must be known to everybody and to you, particularly who is a student of world history, that it was really due to the urge of 100 million Muslims to have a state of their own where they could lead their lives according to their own ideology and where they could develop their own culture and show to the world that, well, there was some way of life which might help the world in establishing peace.
There is a religious foundation, isn't
there, sir? It is, absolutely. The foundation of Pakistan is based on one God, and that all human beings are equal. And that's why I use the expression democracy.
That sounds very familiar to me because of the Human Rights Commission.
Yes, I know that. And let me tell you, it was really a very exciting and sometimes distressing experience because of what happened after Pakistan came into being. On the 3rd of June, the British, who were ruling over that part of the world, decided to give freedom to the subcontinent, which today we call Indo-Pakistan subcontinent, and not the Indian subcontinent, because there are two states now there in that subcontinent. They decided on the 3rd of June that, well, these two countries were to be given their freedom. And we were asked to set up a government and the whole machinery of a government, you know what it means, for 80 million people and a country as large as France, Holland, Belgium, and Italy put together within 2 months.
I don't myself see how you did it.
Well, I'll tell you how we did it. Unity of our people and determination of our people to accept the challenge that was thrown to us.
I think it's very interesting that this country faced very much the same problem that Pakistan faced when we became a new country, Ms. Roosevelt.
You know, I was thinking of that. I wonder if you could tell us, Mr. McGee, some of the things that are similar between our countries, because there are a good many.
Yes. Of course, ours took place a long time ago. But we also were governed by the British before we were independent. We also were basically an agricultural country. We also had the problem of developing our industry. And in developing our industry, we had to make use of foreign capital. It's also true that we had great rivers, which could contribute to our national development, as does Pakistan. We also were a democracy. I hope, however, it doesn't take Pakistan as long to develop their constitution as it did us. Because, if you can recall, it took us some 13 years from the time that it was first suggested that there be a constitution until the constitution was finally ratified in 1789 by the 9 states that were necessary.
And well, now that's an interesting point.
Now you see that you talk of constitution. It seems to me that there is some misconception in this country, not only in this country, but I think in several other countries also, that Pakistan is really working under no constitution. That is not a fact. We have today a constitution which is a democratic constitution. It is really the old Government of India Act, which was passed by the British Parliament in 1935, the basis of which was to give the old India, which was called British India in those days, complete self-government. Well, we have made certain changes in that. And we are working under a constitution where we have our executive, our parliament, which is supreme, our judiciary, which is over and above the executive and the parliament. All that we are now trying to do is this, to frame a constitution which would not be a constitution that was framed by the British, but which would be a constitution framed by the people of Pakistan, which would suit and be in accordance with their own genius. I mean, that is the only difference. But I think this question has been asked, you see, by me. And that's why I interrupted you, Mr. McGee. There seems to be an impression in this country, as well as I think in some other countries also, that Pakistan is really just working under no constitution. It is not a fact. We have a constitution, a democratic constitution, which is more or less, you might say, like the British constitution.
We did exactly the same thing. We took the British constitution and we changed it to suit our own particular problem here. And the development of our two houses, of course, originated from the fact that we had the conflict between the rights of states and the right of federal government, which was one of our basic problems.
Well, now that is very interesting that there should be, you know, this augurs something for the future, I believe, that there is this similarity in the past. Perhaps it means
that
we really are going to work together.
Oh, yes, it does. Not only that, but it would give us inspiration and courage to build Pakistan as strong as your country is.
That sounds...
Because of the similarity that existed at the very birth of the freedom of these two countries.
That sounds very useful to me at the moment. Now, I wonder if I could ask you, Begum Liaquat Ali Khan, because of this constitution, what are the rights of women under the constitution?
The new constitution, Mrs. Roosevelt, is just being formed, is being framed at the moment. And under that, the Muslim women are going to have all the rights given to them by Islam. That means that there's going to be adult franchise where women will vote side by side with men. There'll be equality in services. Women, according to the Islamic laws, inherit. They have the right to divorce. And all this, of course, was 1400 years ago. So the women, so far as the women of Pakistan are concerned, if they are going to be governed by Islamic laws, their condition is going to be far better than what the condition of women is in Western countries, or was. It's only a few years ago that women in the West have got their rights, their yes. civil rights.
But yeah, we have found in our country, and I think it's so in many other countries, that it's one thing to have laws,
yes.
but it takes a little time to actually have those laws function properly.
Yes, you're quite right.
How about that? Because
yes, now so far as that is concerned, you might as well say that Pakistan has performed a miracle, because the women of Pakistan are being given, I mean the elections are going to take place, they're going to vote side by side with men, adult franchise. And not only that, the government has gone one step further and has reserved certain seats for women, besides giving them adult franchise, so that they may see that it works, and that the people will, I mean these certain women that are going to be elected, will definitely be elected, whether they come in the general election or not.
Well, that is very interesting, really, making it almost obligatory for women to take their place.
To be in Parliament,
yes.
and to take their place.
That's very interesting, and I think forward-looking. I wonder if you could tell me, because I think that's one of the things interest many people and is not well understood. What were your principal problems when you first became a separate state?
Well, I tell you, I mean, as I said in the beginning, the first problem was to set up a machinery, an administrative machinery for 80 million people and the area as large as I described at the beginning. The second problem, which I tell you quite frankly, we did not expect, was the influx of refugees into Pakistan.
Were they largely agricultural people?
Agricultural and as well as town people. Would you believe it? That in 6 months, Pakistan got 7 million refugees before Pakistan had opportunity to even set up a government of some sort for all this area. And not only that, but what happened was this, that all the Hindus and the Sikhs, except the Christians, I might say practically all the non-Muslims, were drawn out of Pakistan. And these were the people who had the trade and commerce, banking, and all those things which are necessary for a state or for a country in their hands.
But let me ask you something. There is, in Pakistan, isn't there equality for people of different religions?
Oh yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It was, well, I might have said something more about it before, but in view of the fact that I have recently entered into an agreement with India, I would not like to go into that, because I want to turn over that page, that tragic page of history in Indo-Pakistan relations, and establish new relations with that country based on cooperation and goodwill. Otherwise,
you could do that in many other cases.
Ah, yes, that is true, Mrs. Roosevelt. But I don't want to because I think it would not be right for me when I have entered into an agreement with the country. I feel...
The future cooperation with India, Mr. Prime Minister?
Well, I am because I feel that if these two countries do not cooperate and do not show goodwill, then the future of the East is indeed very dark. And I believe that the future, that the peace of the world depends on peace in that part of the world. And that's why I said that I could have, I mean, if I had come to your states before this agreement, I could have probably given you much more details, which would have, I mean, as we say, raised the hair of the people of America.
I'd just like to say that we feel
I wouldn't like to say that now.
That the understanding reached between the Prime Minister and Mr. Daru constitutes one of the outstanding examples of statesmanship in modern times.
Well, I must say that when I was reading about it, it gave me more encouragement than almost anything I have read lately, because it stands out, I think, as an example of how when statesmen really want to reach agreements, they can be reached, but both sides have to want to reach agreements.
Oh, yes. And apart from that, let me tell you, when Mr. Nehru and myself met, there was no mutual recrimination of the past. We met with the determination and will to solve this problem. And I tell you, we looked at this problem not from political point of view, but from human point of view, because the lives of millions of people was involved in that. And I dare say, if we had, like so many other statesmen, looked at these problems from the political point of view and left the human side of it altogether, we probably would not have reached an agreement.
Of course, sir, if one could always look at the human point of view and much more rarely at the political, even many internal things would be more easily
settled. I agree.
Now, there's one thing that I feel you perhaps, Begum Sahiba, could give me a little picture of. There must have been, anyone who's seen Europe and the refugees there knows what chaos comes to countries with refugees. Now, the women must have had to do something about that problem. How did they meet it?
Yes, when the refugees were coming in, Mrs. Roosevelt, we were not prepared for that influx. And they were coming in by the thousands every day. Of course, we had no hospitals, nowhere to put them up. They had to lie on the roadsides, in camps, and the roads used to be littered with these refugees. Then, of course, we were faced with the problem, no nurses, no doctors. And this was a time, it
very
must be
said. Likely cholera in those conditions.
Oh, yes, cholera, epidemics, smallpox, all sorts of diseases.
Miss Oswald, Miss the Begum is very modest, and I'd like to tell you, because I'm sure she won't, the outstanding part that she played in taking care of this refugee problem. The Begum is indeed a leader on her own right among the women of her country. And I'd like just to confide in you, I hope this doesn't embarrass the Begum, that in Pakistan she is known as the Dynamo in Silks.
Oh, that's a lovely name. I like that, and I'm only sorry that we don't go out today in color to our audience, because I love your dress. It's the most colorful, really.
Mrs. Roosevelt, I can tell you the Dynamo in Silks doesn't impress me so much as when people said I was Mrs. Roosevelt of the East.
Oh, that really interested me. Well, that sounds very, very flattering to me, since you are a good many years younger than I am.
It's the inspiration one gets from people like you, and especially you. I've always admired you, and I only hope that our women will get enough time to train themselves to work for the betterment.
But how did you get nurses?
Then, yes, that is just the problem, you see. We just appealed to the women to come forward and work, regardless of training.
Did they answer?
Oh, yes, they came by the hundreds. And as you know, Mrs. Roosevelt, women can do some sort of nursing even without training. They can look after the wounds, they can look after the children, they can feed the mothers, clean them. 101 things can be done. They came by the hundreds. And this was the awakening of the women of Pakistan. And since then, we have got them in various channels now. We have got them in the regular nursing. We've got them in the All Women's Association, which does social welfare work. We've got them in the Pakistan Women's National Guard, which looks to their physical training as well as to the training in elementary nursing. And you'll be glad to know that our women now are coming forward in every branch of social welfare work.
I must ask you one thing. You who are so interested in these things, would not, to you, it be interesting to see some of the public health work that is done by our nurses, both in rural areas and in urban areas in this country? Or have you already seen that?
No, I haven't already seen it, and that would really be very interesting to me, except for the fact that my program has already been arranged and certain things have been put in it which I would have rather given up to see these sort of things.
Because I remember back to the early days when our nursing services for the public were being more or less started. And here in the city, that is one of the things that helps the average person in the way that I think you must need it there. And I should think it might be helpful for you to get some people, for instance, from the Henry Street nurses here, who've had that experience, to come out and train some of your people there.
Well, that will be very, very helpful indeed, Mrs. Roosevelt, and I hope you will help us.
Oh,
or put us in touch with people whom we can contact.
I will certainly tell
who will come out and help us and teach us.
But that would seem to me to be... And then, of course, the other thing that interests me, and this I turn to you for, sir, Mr. Prime Minister, you must have tremendous engineering things to do, because as I understand it, Western Pakistan needs irrigation,
oh, yes,
doesn't it?
Oh,
well,
yes.
Then, are you going while you're here to TVA? Because that
no.
must be one of the
unfortunately,
type of things that you're about.
That's not on my program.
It's not on your program.
But we have, as a matter of fact, I can say that we have one of the best irrigation systems in Pakistan. And we have certain projects under, only blueprint have been prepared, but actually they are starting. I tell you, in Sindh, province of Sindh, we have an irrigation project which would bring under cultivation 2 million acres of land.
Certainly.
And we are hoping that in the next 3 or 4 years that will be ready. As a matter of fact, our whole object is to develop Pakistan industrially and agriculturally both. I mean, we are not going to sacrifice agriculture at the altar of industry. The both things, as far as our country is concerned, must go side by side if that country of ours is to progress. That is our policy.
Well, the irrigation system in the Punjab in Pakistan is one of the most highly developed in the world.
That's what I said.
We do hope that the Prime Minister will see some of our large dams and reclamation projects when he's in the western part of the United States.
That's what I was wondering about, because I should think with his rivers to develop, those would be extraordinarily useful. You know, I have a very personal interest in your part of the world, because when my father was 21, he went hunting in India and stayed in a great many, and in his letters, which I edited a long, long while ago, I think it's out of print, but if I can find a volume, I will look it up to give you, just because of that.
I shall be very grateful.
But I know it's out of print, but I shall see. But in any case, it has interest to me, because in those letters, the names that are familiar to me are Lahore, and any number of Kashmir he went up to, and any number of the places have always been tied to those old letters that as a child I was allowed to read with great interest and excitement, because it was in those days a great adventure.
Oh, yes.
To go around the world, you see.
It was
many years ago. Many people didn't do it then.
And if I may say so, your father went to the best part of that subcontinent when he went to Lahore and all those places.
Well, that I think is a nice thing for you to say. You should feel that way. But transportation must be one of your problems. How you're a divided country with tremendous territory.
Oh, yes.
How do you get from one part of it to the other?
Yes, I tell you what, I mean, that is really one of the problems that we have to face, whether it's due to geography and the other considerations. Really speaking, the only sure and safe way, or shall I say, means of communication between East Pakistan and West Pakistan is by sea or by air. I am hoping that when our relations with India improve, then it would be possible to have land communication also. Because
jointly built railroad or a jointly built
We have. As a matter of fact, we have the railway system from one part to the other, because you see, the whole of the subcontinent was one. And as a matter of fact, in the olden days, a railway train, I think you call it by some other name, but anyhow we call it railway train, from Peshawar right up in the north, used to go right up to Calcutta, right to the east.
Oh, yes.
So therefore, I mean, all that system is there. It's only the political consideration which don't allow that system to develop.
Well, probably with your new understanding and with trade broadening, you will very soon come to some kind of arrangements, because there's a real reason for wanting to do so. But I think now, how in eastern Pakistan, how are the airfields?
Oh, yes, we have many of them, thanks to the Americans.
because
during the war, the Americans were there.
Yeah.
And they built a number of airfields in East Pakistan, because the danger was from Burma, the Japanese.
Naturally, from the Japanese.
And we have, as a matter of fact, there is regular service by air between East and West Pakistan. And therefore, I mean, we have these services. It isn't that East Pakistan is cut off completely from West Pakistan.
No.
And by sea also, we have a regular...
How long does it take by sea?
It takes 12 days.
12 days. That's quite a long while,
yes,
when you think about it, because 12 days is a deal of time. Well, I would like just to tell you again, both of you, how much I appreciate your being with us today, and to sum up a little for our audience the fact that we have talked about a nation which has great interest to our nation, because trade between us, our mutual interests, will mean much in the future to the peace of the world. I don't have to ask my audience for their opinions today.
You have been one of the welcome guests on this, the 13th of Mrs. Roosevelt's Sunday afternoon teas at the Park Sheraton Hotel in New York City. You've been listening to a discussion on Pakistan Looks to the Future by Liaquat Ali Khan, Prime Minister of Pakistan, Begum Liaquat Ali Khan, and Assistant Secretary of State George C. McGee. Next week, you're cordially invited to be present when human rights in the United Nations will be discussed. Mrs. Roosevelt, who is chairman of the Human Rights Commission, will have as her guests the officers of the commission: Dr. P.C. Chang, representing China; Monsieur René Cassin, representing France; Dr. Charles Malik, representing Lebanon, along with Dr. Maurice Perlswag, consultant to the United Nations Economic and Social Council from the World Jewish Congress, and Mrs. Eunice H. Carter, member of the Human Rights Committee of the American Association for the United Nations, two representatives of two non-governmental agencies. This program has been an Elliot Roosevelt and Martin Jones production. Today with Mrs. Roosevelt is one of the programs being recorded for use by the Voice of America for its international transmissions. Our subject next week: human rights and the United Nations. Do join us next week.
See television.